right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show.
Wow.
I'm really psyched about today. Of course, I'm psyched every time I get to be on the radio and talk to you because it's just that much of a privilege, okay? It's just that much of being able to do what I actually want to do in terms of changing this world, standing up against all the insanity and doing it in a way that we can actually change the world and bring on a whole other way of living. And that's what I'm really stoked about. So today's show is going to be full of that. At the back end of the show, we are going to be listening to an interview I did with Stanley Nelson, the director of the Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, the first documentary on the most prominent revolutionary group during the 1960s. And I had a chance to talk to Stanley when I was up in Sundance. Now, we did an hour-long interview, a little bit more than an hour, and we're going to run a certain amount of it today. We won't be able to run the whole thing, but we will run a good part of it, and it'll give you a taste. And before that, we'll be talking with Sharon Irwin and Andrea Irwin, the grandmother and mother of Tony Robinson, a 19-year-old black man murdered by the Madison, Wisconsin police on March 6, 2015. They're going to be talking about Tony, his life and death, and the importance of Rise Up October. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show the first time, you know, he was on it earlier, many times when I first started the show. In fact, he was one of the first guests I ever had on my show. Ed Asner. Ed's an award-winning actor, a man with a heart that's a gigantic heart and a sharp brain, and who has never hesitated to step out and fight for what's right and what's needed in the world. Ed, welcome to the show.
I got cut to the chase.
Oh, man, I want to wrestle with a grizzly bear this hour of the morning, brother. Yeah. Let me ask you something, man. You signed onto the call for Rise Up October, which is 3 days in New York, including on the 24th, a day aimed at filling the streets with people who will no longer tolerate police murder of brown and black people.
Right.
I want to know why you did that, why you signed onto it.
Well, you twisted my arm.
You know, I was sitting there last night, and I told my wife, I know he's going to say that. Okay, let's get beyond that.
He twisted both arms. No, it was impossible. And he's fairly strong, you know. He's fairly strong. I did it because you led me and coerced me to contribute to this effort. I have no idea how successful it will be, but my feeling was that if all those people that are cited to be appearing and speaking there can ignite this large assemblage, and hopefully the weather will finally be good, that it will create a spark that will generate throughout the country, and people will be. I made some comment about people lie in a fen of inactivity and hopelessness and negativity. If the march in the assemblage in New York works, maybe it will provide the spark that will awaken the sleeping giant of the people of the United States.
Let me ask you this. Let me read people what you wrote recently. And it was a statement for Rise Up October and October 24th in particular.
Yeah.
You said, when people become inspired en masse, which is not too often, they can leave their stupidity behind and truly move mountains and advance the glory of mankind. October 24th can well be one of those rare occasions when this occurs. Let's talk about that.
Well, I believe it. I'm counting on you and your fellow promulgators to achieve this effect. If you don't achieve it, I'm going to dismiss you.
Okay, well.
Are you listening?
Yeah, yes. Right. Yeah, I can't help but hear you, okay? Right. You've got a clear voice, and I got
all those people responding to your fund drive request to demand their money back if you fail on October 24th.
Well, you know, there's a thing, actually, you're raising a point, because actually October 24th has to happen, and it has to be this kind of thing that we're talking about. And one of those things I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, I was reading Niemöller's quotes the other day, and I was thinking, well, a lot of people know that poem about first they came for the communists, yeah. I didn't speak up. But there was a second quote that he said, which I think is really, and very few people ever talk about this. It was right after he got released from the concentration camp that he had been in for 7 years for opposing the Nazis. And he said, we preferred to keep silent. We are certainly not without guilt or fault. And I ask myself again and again, what would have happened if in the year 1933 or 1934, 14,000 Protestant pastors and all Protestant communities in Germany had defended the truth until their deaths. If we had said back then, it's not right when Hermann Goering simply puts 100,000 communists in concentration camps in order to let them die, I can imagine that perhaps 30,000 to 40,000 Protestant Christians would have had their heads cut off, but I can also imagine that we would have rescued 30 to 40 million people because this is what it cost us. What do you think of that?
I think it's glorious. You know, granted, of course, it's hindsight. We're all geniuses at that. But Germany is paying through the nose now for what it did then. And I am proud of what the Germans have become out of the Holocaust that they created. So it can have, and all the other countries around Germany are going to rot, and they're speaking ill, and they're speaking evil, and they were the sufferers. So I guess we're the two faces of the hyena.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I asked you this question is because I know you and I have talked about this a lot, and it's this point about people have a responsibility to raise their voice and to actually take this stuff on. You know, the silent majority, I was just on the way over to the station this morning, I was listening to a piece called Silent Majority, which is by Eddie Harris with Gene McDaniels. And he talks about the silent majority better stop being silent or we're all going to be silent very quickly.
It will be seen by, we've got a little over a year now to the next election. And we'll see what kind of stature the voters and the people of America give us when they elect the next president and the next Congress. And, of course, we keep hedging our bets. We keep putting in a far-right president, and then we elect a liberal Congress. We never try to do the same thing at the same time. It's to negate each other, and a lot of it creates non-motion, non-growth for once. I'd like to see what we do when we elect the same party or the same group of activists in both the executive and in Congress.
You know, there's something that actually strikes me, though, which is another thing to consider, which is when you talk about, you know, the need to actually stop this, police terror and murder, when you talk about the need to actually change a society, we are dealing with something that's societal. And I know you've been one of the people. When I think of somebody who has stood up against police brutality and injustice, I'm serious about this now, man. I'm not kidding around with you or looking for a snappy response. But ever since I've known you, man, you have been one of the most outspoken people in Hollywood, whether it was El Salvador, whether it was Mumia. There was all kinds of stuff around that, you know, when the war broke out after 9/11, all this other stuff. You've stood up against it. When I had you on my show, you came on the day that they declared Homeland Security as an official department of the U.S. government. And you compared that to Nazi Germany. I was listening to that last night as I was, you know, just thinking about what we would talk about. You know, you've always been there. You've always raised your voice. And you've been hit for it, but you never backed down. Why?
I'm too dumb to.
Ah, the hell with that. I told you, no snappy remarks, man. Really, why? Well, I mean, it's serious because...
I'm like a little kid. I said, no, you can't have that. That's mine. And I guess the same applies to my feeling about ideas and causes. When I was branded as a communist for supporting the medical aid to El Salvador, it was not that I was being a communist. I was being what I call being a humanist. They needed the medical aid. So I was happy to be part of the board that gave it to them. But people are too easily confusing when they come to discuss humanism and communism. And unfortunately, capitalism is far behind on those elements. We've got to make capitalists and capitalism more benevolent than they certainly have a record for.
I would put that in the land of, okay, we're dreaming. And for me, that can only be a nightmare. When you look at a system that's actually based on all this stuff, and this is another argument, but a system that's
It'll be a probable goal. You establish that as your goal, then they can't call you a communist.
But I want to be called a communist, so that's where we'll have you back on to talk about that. Let me bring on right now, I'd like to bring on Sharon Irwin and have her talk a little bit about this, all right? Because Sharon is the mother of Tony Robinson, who was killed by the police in Madison, Wisconsin, back on March 6th of 2015. So let me bring Sharon on and just have her join in the conversation. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
You were the grandmother of Tony Robinson. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm a grandmother. Yeah. I'm his grandma.
Let's talk about this. Tell people what happened to Tony Robinson.
On March 6th, he was shot and killed by the Madison police. He was actually murdered. The man shot him 7 times on a video, and we were told that he was justified in the shooting. So I have been standing up a whole lot more. In fact, I have, you know, I've known about and who Ed Asner is for a very long time, because I am myself almost 60 years old, and I appreciate his comments about and his willingness to be out there as an activist and to take the slams that he takes. And the people saying, no, 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 because it's not an easy path to rock. And I understand that. I too, am looking for numbers in New York with Rise Up October. I also understand that people are so, don't want to come out of their comfort zone. And coming and standing up is coming out of your comfort zone. And I make people uncomfortable.
Let me bring on Andrea Irwin, who's Tony's mother.
Well done, darling. Well done.
Thank
I'm proud
you.
To know you.
Mm-hmm. You too.
Andrea, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Hi.
Hi, how are you? And you're Tony Robinson's mother. Why don't you tell us what happened to Tony?
My son was a normal 19-year-old kid finding his way in life. I'm just starting out. Happened to ingest some form of a substance, hanging out with his friend, to a point where he needed help. He needed that medical assistance. His friends called the police. And the police officer that showed up didn't afford my son the right to even have a chance to acknowledge or even know a police officer was there. He showed up and went in and was malice and shot and killed my son 7 times. My son died in the dark hallway looking at the man that killed him. And what it's done for us in our community is my mom is in the street. She keeps his name alive, and she's the one that says, let the world know I'm in the bottom in grassroots with the activists in the city trying to make, I need to make change. We need to make sure this stops. This is an epidemic. My son was a beautiful young man in Madison, Wisconsin, thought this was never going to happen here. And it's happened here. It's happening everywhere. My son has just become a part of an epidemic that is nationwide. And if we don't make up, stand up, just like going and becoming a large group in New York or in Ferguson, Missouri, or Madison, Wisconsin, and make a stand and say to the world, we have to stop. There will be more children dying. There's going to be a civil war.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ed Asner, award-winning actor and activist, and Sharon Irwin and Andrea Irwin, the grandmother and mother of Tony Robinson, a 19-year-old black man murdered by a Madison, Wisconsin cop on March 6th, 2015. Now, Sharon, let's go back to you for a minute. Sharon, tell me something. One of the things that I wanted to also talk about is that when the cop went in and, I mean, basically he dragged your grandson's body from where he was shot down the steps out into the street like it was a bag of garbage. And he then went and said that he had no choice but to shoot. And when he says this and he describes all this stuff, it's actually he fired those 7 bullets all within 18 seconds of being there.
Exactly.
Let's talk about that a little.
Okay. Well, I have actually requested and received all the evidence that they gathered. And I found out a lot. And I put the story together myself. And I know what really happened. And I say this, there is no honor in a lie. There is no justification in a lie, and there is no justice in a lie. And I have caught this man lying. So what happened, and it started with this, my grandson was coming down the stairs, and you must remember he was high. He was not aware the police officer was there. He never introduced himself. There are 12 steps. My grandson is 6'4". He takes the steps when he's running 3 at a time. Matt Kenny, in a statement to his sergeant, said, and I quote, I got possibly halfway when he came around the corner. So that would have made it about 5 or 6 steps. But in his statement, he says he goes all the way up the stairs. They get into a huge fight. He falls back down to the eighth stair. My grandson beats his brains out in a hole in the wall, and he had to shoot him because he was afraid he was going to lose unconsciousness. What he tells his sergeant was, I possibly went upstairs. He went around the corner. Are you okay? Yes, I'm okay. Were you hurt? I only got hit once. I'm okay. This is the man that gave CPR to my grandson. I heard him. This is evidence that I heard. They totally just like forget there's a bullet hole at the top of the stairs in the wall behind where my grandson was running down, which means the man shot at him before he made contact with him. But nobody's talking about that bullet hole. Mm-hmm. I can't even find out how many bullets he shot out of his gun. Mm-hmm. The fact that they gave this officer all the evidence, let him sit down for an hour and a half.
3 hours.
And then make a statement. There's no justice in anything that's done.
Right. Now,
they ignore it. Not from the DA, not from the city of Madison, not from the police department. They start a smear campaign against him, and they do this with everybody they shoot.
Mm-hmm. Now, Andrea, let's talk with you a minute, because you were chiming in there and you say it was 3 hours and they've refused. They've exonerated the cop, right?
Exactly. They exonerated him. The DA decided to call me with the information of the non-indictment on Mother's Day, which took away my entire... I have three surviving children who were all trying to grieve their oldest brother. He decided Mother's Day was not a day I was to be afforded this year after losing my son. Mm-hmm. What they've done in this city has been ridiculous from the beginning. They kept me from my child in the hospital. I wasn't allowed to see him. They locked us out of the hospital when none of us were being hostile. They separated me from my family. I was told my son was dead when I was alone. From the beginning, they went against my son with lies. Mm-hmm. They publicly released my address knowing that we had been getting threatened. Like, the city has gone above and beyond to hurt us because the fact of what they've done, that what happened to my son, they know. The man that murdered my son murdered another man in 2007 under some really odd circumstances and was given the Medal of Valor for shooting a man in his head who had a pellet gun. But now he has murdered yet another person, a 19-year-old unarmed black child. Had become a part of a national conversation. Well, the city's not going to say that this man they gave the Medal of Valor to is a murderer, even though he's a murderer. And all of the evidence that we're uncovering shows that not only is he a murderer, but the city is so much trying to save their face and how we're supposed to be the number three city in the United States to live, that they'll allow this murderer to continue to go on with his life. Now, as of now, he is back to work, but in an unarmed position, training other police officers.
Yeah.
My children have had to see this man in the street.
Let me real quick, I want to get back to Ed for a minute. Ed, you know, this sort of adds, I think, to me, and my thing as I was thinking about this, it adds a little bit more to that Niemöller quote I was talking about, that if we don't stand up, what actually, you can see this unfolding. This is gaining. Black and brown people, disproportionately the targets of, and they're killed disproportionately in disproportionate numbers than any other group in society, and particularly black people. And black people, mainly, it's been when, you know, disproportionately high numbers that have been, they didn't have a weapon. You know, let's talk about this a little bit, but where does this sit with you in terms of the need, like you're speaking out, but how the hell do we get to these people that are in Hollywood that have a platform to say something? What do we have to say to people to get them to stand up and say, no, I will not stand and watch this go down?
I think that's been a universal cry from the beginning of man climbing down out of the trees. You just have to keep applying your nose to the grindstone. And hopefully you'll strike the sparks that ignite people and to get away from your nose. It's a constant, unfolding, unending universal problem. And I'm very impressed at how well the grandmother and the mother have described the incidents, how well-spoken they are, and I think you've gained some new support by just hearing them today. I also at the same time wonder, whether Scott Walker reflects what Wisconsin has become, or whether he has created this influence by his campaigning and his utterances. It's a subject to be discussed. Mm-hmm. I thank God that he no longer is a candidate for president and should never have been, but let's hope we are successful in weeding out some of the other trash.
All right, Ed, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I'm going to real quick go back to Andrea and Sharon. Andrea, why do you think October 24th is so damn important? Give people a reason why they need to be there.
The thing with what's been going on, and it's not like it's new, it just seems to be more prevalent in the media, is awareness. It's the more people that know what is going on, the more people that have it in their face, it's power by numbers. And the more numbers you have, it seems to be in every case that's ever made any difference and change in this country, is that people don't start paying attention until they start seeing the numbers of people that are starting to believe in the same thing. And then they say, maybe they're onto something. There's many people we can get to come and stand up, and we're all saying, look at what is happening. And we hold signs with the amounts of names of people and cities and ages of these people, these babies, these fathers and sons and people that are dying. That makes people have to look at what we're doing and say, well, look, why are they doing that? And it's now in my face. I can't ignore it. Now look at how many people there are. It's not just two. It's not ten. Now it's thousands. Then it's millions. And then things can happen.
All right, Andrea, I want to thank you. Let me get back to Sharon. And Sharon, let me give you a chance to talk about this. Why are you calling on people to be in New York on October 24th?
Mike, I'll tell you, I agree with you in terms of when you were talking to Ed about the similarities in the regime of Hitler. We're not even looking at that. This happened because everybody thought, if I shut my door and go in my house, I'm all right. I'll be all right. Well, we're not going to be all right. There's 7 billion of us out here. And I know if we stood up, there is nothing that could stop us. Absolutely nothing. And I feel, right now, I feel like I'm a butterfly. And I'm flapping my wings. And I want to cause a tsunami across this world. And we can all get up and be butterflies together. I don't feel like if we do this in a violent manner, that all we're doing is changing faces. We need to change the structure. And what we are talking about is a system that doesn't want to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore will come for us.
Okay, well, I want to, you know, both of you, actually, this has been, I wish we had a lot more time, but as it always happens, we have a schedule to follow here, and I have to follow it. So I want to thank Ed. Thank you very much for joining us.
I grieve at your loss, ladies. I grieve.
Ed, thank you. It was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you very much, Michael Slater. I enjoyed this. And Andy, I love you.
And Sharon, yes, thank you. And Andrea, thank you very much, too. Okay?
Thank you.
All.
All right. Take care. We've been talking with Ed Asner and Sharon Irwin and Andrea Irwin, the grandmother and mother of Tony Robinson, killed by the Madison, Wisconsin police on March 6, 2015. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was The Lumpin' with Free Bobby Now, and that's from the album Listen Whitey. And The Lumpin' was a funk band that was formed by the Panthers and played at Panther rallies and gatherings all over the country. All right, now we're going to go to the interview I did with Stanley Nelson, the director of the Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. I carried this out in the middle of a snowstorm in a crowded hotel, so that's why the sound's a little, there's a little background noise. But it was a very, very deep interview, and it ranged over more than an hour. But unfortunately, due to the limits of time, we're only going to be able to play a portion of this interview. But you'll be able to hear the interview in its entirety at my website, themichaelslateshow.com. So without any further ado, let's jump into the interview with Stanley Nelson, director of the Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. All right, Stanley Nelson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Yeah. For somebody to step out and do a history of the Black Panther Party right now is, one, so on the mark, but two, is also a mammoth project. When I heard that you were doing this, and then as I was sitting down and I was thinking about, when I'm just about to watch it at the premiere, I'm thinking, all right, I got to see what Stanley did with this, because this is a bear. And I love the way you open up the film, because it kind of captures that in a certain sense. So can you talk about that a little?
About the opening of the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, when we were interviewing Erica Huggins, who was a very prominent member of the Panthers, she off the cuff just told us the story and compared the Panthers to the story of the blind man and the elephant, where, you know, one touches the side and thinks it's a wall, another touches the trunk and thinks it's a snake, etc. And that just seemed to be such a metaphor for the Panthers. And it also was a way, in a way, it freed us. It freed us from saying, you know, we can tell you everything about this thing, because we can. It's like trying to say what an elephant is by touching different parts of it. You can never get the whole. You know, nobody knows the whole story, and there is no whole story to the Panthers, because it depended where you were, when you were, who you were in the party, what your relationship to the party was. So, you know, we set the film up with the story of the elephant, and we actually did some beautiful animation to kind of illustrate it, to set you up and say, in some ways, you know, we're going to tell you the story as best we can, but there are other stories of the Panthers that are just as valid.
You know, it's interesting, because I was thinking about the complexity of it that you're speaking about, which is, you know, because I know when I was sitting there myself, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, what about this? And what about this?
Right.
And then I caught myself, I said, wait a minute, step back a minute and appreciate the film and appreciate the struggle to actually wade through all that and to hone what was really a central trunk.
Right.
You know, which was very important, because I think it was even more complex than your previous films on that kind of, on that movement era.
And No, it's a very complex movement. And as you say, one thing that's interesting is most people, or a lot of people, know something about the Panthers, you know, and especially people who are my age and probably your age, you know, are kind of around. And so we know a little bit, and more than a little bit, about the Panthers, and we know certain stories. And what we wanted to do is, as you say, is give you the trunk of the tree. We can't give you every branch. And so what was really important for us is that when we go down one branch, that it then connects back to the tree. And so there are lots of stories about the Panthers that don't kind of, we felt, are great stories and are kind of illustrative of certain things, but they don't bring you back to the tree. They just go off on a branch. So we really wanted to try to get to tell stories that come back and really are part of this whole tree that gives you a real sense of the totality of the Panthers.
Just one more point on this first question. What really compelled you to do this? Because this is, you know, like you're saying, it's a great story. On the other hand, it's a story too. The Panthers themselves, for a group that had as much broad influence as it did, and it's true, if you walked around in any city or any area in the United States, or even in other countries at some point, and you ran into radical-minded black people, and some who weren't even that radical-minded, they'd say, yeah, I was in the Panthers.
Right.
You know?
Right. There must have been a million people in the Panthers, at least at some point. But I think, well, you know, when you ask any filmmaker, you know, what drove them to make a film, especially a documentary film, it's more than one reason. So when they tell you the one reason, that's the reason that they've agreed on with their publicist. But so for us, you know, I mean, one thing was, I was 15 years old when the Panthers started in 1966. I was living in New York. I did not have a religious background. So the Panthers really appealed to me, because they were talking about problems in the North. Yeah, they were not religious based, as even the black Muslims were, and they just looked so cool and so different. And you know, 15-year-old, you're like, wow, you know, and you know, Martin Luther King and those guys, you know, Ralph Abernathy, they may look cool now in those suits that like have come back, you know, and they, you know, the 60s suits, but back then they did not look cool to a 15-year-old, you know, but the Panthers did, and they were so in your face, and it was so different. But the filmmaker reason is look, those people in the Panthers 50 years ago were very young. They were 20 years old, basically. So now they're still, you know, in their late 60s, early 70s. So a lot of them are very vital. The Panthers were also media darlings. So there's so much footage, so many pictures, you know, so much stuff to work with as a filmmaker that it became, you know, really interesting. And also that even though it's a huge story, it's a story that lasted, you know, 7, 8 years in its prime. So it is a containable story. It has a lot of branches, as you said, but it is a, it's not a story that lasts, you know, 150 years. It's 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Nelson, the director of The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, the first documentary on the most prominent revolutionary group during the 1960s.
At the same time, in a certain sense, the impact of it has, I mean, it's true today, in everything from art to a kid who's just waking up. I mean, I have a friend, he's a cartoonist, he's a white guy, and one of the biggest influences on his life to this day is the BPP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
right. Right. I mean, the Black Panthers influence is really, you know, today is really cultural. Very few things that they fought for came to fruition, and we could talk about that later. But culturally, they changed. They changed Black America. And if you change Black America, you change America. You know, before the Panthers, Black people were not known to be kind of in your face. That's not who we were. But after the Panthers, you know, that's who we're thought of now. You know, by, you know, the whole hip-hop culture could not have come about without the Panthers, without that kind of attitude that the Panthers carried. So, you know, and also this whole Black as cool was not there before that. So the Panthers culturally had so much influence. And I think that also, you know, so many young people know a little bit about the Panthers because of their cultural influence, but they don't know the story.
You know, yeah, exactly. Now, one of the things I wanted to get into here is that you make a point in the film of saying that the Panthers emerged in a certain time, and were shaped by that time. And Elaine Brown made an interesting comment when she talked about what she was doing at the time and when she, right before she joined the Panthers. And then she said, look, part of it is I couldn't unsee what I've seen.
Right.
And that really drove her. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because the Panthers being shaped, emerging from a certain time, but also being shaped by the time and helping to shape the time as it went along.
Right. The Panthers, you know, came directly out of the civil rights movement. And so people like Elaine, you know, in L.A. and in Oakland and in New York and Chicago, you know, what the civil rights movement was fighting for were not our same issues exactly. You know, we could sit at a restaurant pretty much. You know, we could ride on buses. You know, we could vote. We were involved emotionally. So we were involved in this emotionally in this thing, this civil rights movement that was changing the whole country. So how do you get involved? You know, how do you become part of this? Well, the Panthers offered this way to be part of it, to really dedicate part of your life or your life to changing the society.
But there was a difference too, because they, in terms of the difference from the civil rights movement, one, they were based in the urban north by and large in the beginning, even though they did spread throughout the South fairly quickly. But they were also the people that they were appealing to. They used to call it what, the brother on the block.
Right.
But then also just the program, the whole thing, all that was had a very distinct difference between the civil rights movement and what it was concentrating on. It's as important as that was, what it was concentrating on and how it was shaping up and what the Panthers were.
Right. Well, there's a small section in the film which I really love because we kind of put it in fairly late and we were able to include it, where they talk about the 10-point program, but they also talk about the fact that they did not believe that a capitalist system can work for everybody. And part of the reason why the capitalist system in the United States works for some people is because it doesn't work for other people. And so, you know, there was a basis for what they were saying. It was not just, you know, we want to. It was like, no, this system is not working for Black people who are kind of this permanent underclass. And that's why it works for other people. And so we have to, as they say, as I think Elaine Brown says in the film, we have to dismantle this system and start over with a different system that can serve all the people. You know, so that's one of the, it comes out of the one of the slogans, all power to the people. And so I think, again, I'm really, you know, proud of the fact that we were able to fit that in, because one of the things we argued about in the edit room is, can we talk about the fact that they were basically socialists? And can we at least mention that? Or does that then alienate people? Because, you know, we're at a time, you know, we're almost back into the 50s, where you can't mention socialism or communism without, you know, being a demon. So I'm really proud that we were able to at least mention it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine doing a film on the Panthers that wouldn't speak about their anti-capitalism, their advocate. I mean, look, I like what you did in the film where you had Mao Zedong says free Dewey,
right.
And you had a couple scenes where people were reading red books, and I know that had to be somewhat conscious in terms of putting it in there, you know, in terms of putting that footage in there.
Yeah.
Because, but it is important to show that the Panthers, that's the other difference. The Panthers weren't looking to fit into the society. They were looking to do a whole new society to get rid of this one, do a whole new one.
Right. Well, I think the Panthers in that way were ahead of their time. I mean, they realized, you know, as in some ways Malcolm X did, that the civil rights movement, some of the things we're fighting for in the civil rights movement, were just band-aids. You know, so, and that's what it's proved to be. I mean, you know, you can vote and you can, you know, sit on a bus and, you know, you can eat at a restaurant, but it doesn't get to the core problems of, that we have as African Americans in the United States. You know, I mean, things have changed for some people a great deal since the 60s, but for most people, most African Americans, things have not changed that much.
Mm-hmm. And that's what was so refreshing, even at the time, for the Panthers to actually step out so boldly and say, exactly, we're not about putting a Band-Aid on, this is about revolution. I mean, no one popularized the word revolution as much as the Panthers did.
Well, I think that, as you said, the Panthers, as someone says in the film, you know, were after the brother on the block. You know, that's who they were after. And they knew that the civil rights movement was not going to really help them. How do you help the fact that our education system is not working? How do you help the fact that police brutality it was the same in the North as it was in the South? How do you help that?
That's the thing. And I wanted to go back to the point that you started to speak to earlier at the beginning of the interview, the swagger. And the audaciousness, because that said something to the people, to people who have been not only marginalized, but actually almost pushed underground in a sense of an entire people. And that swagger, that audaciousness to declare, one, no, you're not going to do this, and two, to say to the people, you got to get up out of this stuff and you got to follow us because we are the vanguard.
Right. I think that one of the things that we don't think about a lot of times in this country is that, you know, that this swagger that the Panthers brought was not there before. One of the things that we forget is that African Americans, you know, up until the 20s and 30s in there were thought of as country. You know, if you said country, you meant black. You know, you could say, you know, and that's what we were thought of as country people. Then the Great Migration brought black people to the North. But there was never this kind of in-your-face swagger. And it was never seen in the media. So the first time we really saw black people in the media was when we saw, you know, Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, who, you know, purposefully, as part of their tactics, you know, wore suits and ties and had that certain look, you know. Like, we're not only your equal, but we can dress better. You know, the Panthers said, you know, no, we're having a whole different look because we're after a different kind of person. And it's not only our look, it's our attitude. And I think one of the calculated things that the Panthers did, which was brilliant, was to say, you know, we're going to look like this, we're going to be in your face, and certain people, white and black, are going to be alienated by this. They're going to hate us just as soon as they see us, as soon as they see the way we talk and walk. But there's another portion of people who are going to be attracted to us, and those are the people we want. The people who are going to be repelled by us, we're never going to get them. So we're not going to even try. You know, we're going to go after that other side, and there's enough of those people for us to start a movement.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Nelson, the director of The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, the first documentary on the most prominent revolutionary group during the 1960s.
All right, and there's another aspect of this thing that was the swagger and the boldness and the audaciousness around it was the fact that in that situation and in those times, it's really the footage you use to show what was going on in those times and to show both the massive repression, but also there's scenes where you're talking about, you know, the cops coming out and what it was like to be a young black man on the streets, and you're showing the cops throw these guys against the wall, and this one guy, he's surrounded by cops and he just starts fist fighting with the cop.
Right.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is something that actually shows what the times were beginning to be like. But it took the Panthers come in. And with all the stuff of presenting themselves as like a discipline, a serious, I mean, that's what the leather coats and the berets and the buttons and the, you know, they were an organized force that was about something that was going to change people's lives, you know? And I kept thinking about that in relation to this whole point around them saying, not only were we an organized force, but we were saying, we are the vanguard of a revolution. And you need to be part of this, but to be part of it, you got to get behind us.
Right. I think that that's something that if you weren't around at that and those times, has largely been forgotten. That so many of us, and I again was 15 at that time and grew up, you know, kind of became an adult during this period. So many of us felt that we were in the midst of a revolution, and that things were going to drastically change. We believed that. And it wasn't only the people who were in the Panthers or in SDS or anything like that. I was never part of those groups. I was a college student, but I believed it, and so did everybody else that I knew. I would guess that on any, pretty much any college campus, you would have 60, 70, 80% of people who believed that. I mean, it was a common belief among young people that the fundamental way that this society worked in the United States was undergoing a revolution and would change. And I think that what happened was that we've undergone a cultural revolution. Now, things have changed culturally, but in terms of politically, things are pretty much the way they were. But to talk about that feeling, I think we had to try to give you a basis in that, in the film, because that's what permeated the whole times, you know. And so that's the only way you can understand the Panthers, who were on TV every night, you know, talking about revolution. You know, every night, you know, it was some other story about the Panthers talking about revolution. I mean, when's the last time you heard anybody talk about revolution on the news today?
The other thing in that is that part of why the Panthers paid so much attention to that aspect of things, too, was that they had, and you bring this out, and it was an interesting way of phrasing it, because I hadn't really thought about it exactly in those terms, but that they were also, part of this whole scene was setting new standards that they wanted. They were actually insisting that the community follow, which I thought was a really, you know, you can't have a revolutionary movement without setting new standards, but they saw themselves as taking responsibility for the whole community, not just their group, but like, these are standards that we got to live by.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why we titled the film Vanguard of the Revolution, you know. We came to that title late. I think our working title was The Black Panther Seized the Time. And as we were editing, you know, we came to the idea of Vanguard of the Revolution late. One of the things that happened for us was that so many people started kind of, in the interviews, kind of using the word vanguard in different ways, you know. And so I think the term vanguard became central to our understanding the Panthers. They were not saying that we want everyone to join the Panthers or we expect everyone to join the Panthers, but that we are out in front of this movement. We are the leader. We are, you know, we are in some ways putting ourselves on the line so that you can follow. It always reminded me of kind of Indian scouts in the Old West. You know, we'll go out there in the front, and if there's any Indians out there, they'll shoot at us first, because that's who we are. We're the scouts, and that's, I think, how the Vanguard, how the Black Panthers looked at themselves. And it's important to understand that, because one of the things that you have to understand is, what did they want? And they didn't want to become a political party, and they didn't want to have everybody join the Panthers. They wanted to set an example and say, you know, this is something that you all can think about. You don't have to take police brutality sitting down. You can fight back.
That's a good point, and that brings up another aspect of things which I thought in my life actually made a big difference. And it was the fact that the Panthers, the BPP, depended so much on their newspaper. And that, in a way, that was the way that they actually reached out with even whatever forces they had, even as big as they got. The paper still became the main voice that could reach into many other places that they could physically go, but also helped set an entire atmosphere in society. Can you talk about the role of the paper?
Yeah, I mean, and the paper plays, you know, a large role in the film. We talk about the paper, and, you know, from the very beginning in writing proposals, we knew we wanted to talk about the paper, because that was the endpoint for so many people to the Black Panther Party. You know, in cities all across the country, they had a weekly paper, and in cities all across the country, they would be out on the streets selling the paper. And they would not only be in the Black communities, they would go everywhere and sell the paper. And that, it was like this thing where every, you know, you just on the street corners, they were selling this paper. And invariably, you would have access at some point to the paper. You might be sitting in the barbershop and there it was. You might buy a paper. It might be sitting next to you on the bus or the subway. You pick it up. And that's where you got an idea of who the Panthers really were and what they wanted, because it wasn't filtered through the mainstream news, you know, opinion of the Panthers, but it was what the Panthers were saying. And it was very, very, very important to the spread of the Panthers, and also to you know, people who might not have wanted to listen, to picking up and quietly being and saying, wait a minute, these guys aren't crazy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Nelson, the director of The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, the first documentary on the most prominent revolutionary group during the 1960s.
And one of the things you say in the film is you say everything came together in the paper regarding the BPP?
Yeah, the paper was, you know, when you open the paper, the 10-point platform and program was the first thing you saw. So that was the first page, was the platform and program. Then there were other articles about what was going on, and some international articles, what was going on. There was an affinity towards China and Cuba and what was going on in those places. But also, you know, Panther business around the country. News if a young African-American had been shot or things like that. So it was really a kind of an endpoint for so many people. And, you know, one of the great things in the film is there's a whole series of pictures, you know, with an old white woman on the subway reading the Black Panther paper, an old guy laying out in the grass with two soldiers, you know, in full uniform, you know, white soldiers in uniform, you know, reading the Panther paper. So, I mean, it was something that was very, very famous, was in your face at the time. Everybody saw the Panther paper and knew that this thing existed.
One of the things that you talk about in the film that I was so happy to see was the inclusion and the focus for a period of time on the work of Emery Douglas. Now, here's an artist who, in terms of political cartooning, really, I mean, that was so brilliant, the work that he did in relation to that. But there were so many other things about the Panthers that came to life for people through that, and also about the system and who, like, for instance, we'll talk about this as part of this, but for instance, the portrayal of the police as pigs, and maybe even the whole concept of calling them pigs.
You know, Emery's artwork was the way for so many of us to get into, you know, the Panther paper. You know, his artwork most times was on the cover, you know, big artwork. And Emery he's just an incredible artist, and he kind of had two styles. So one were these very, very beautiful, colorful cartoons that kind of took from the Cuban and Chinese revolutionary art. And so those were just brilliant, 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 and beautiful, beautiful drawings. And then he had this other kind of very political, much, much more kind of caricatures of the police and the government and things like that, that were also just so pointed. You know, even in looking back and researching this film, some of those drawings were like, whoa, you know, nobody would do that now, you know. So we really wanted to try to give the audience an idea of the Panther movement, and Emery was a huge part. It was just a huge, you know, way in. It's like, you know, you've got this movement that's growing, and you have, you know, these great spokespeople, but you also have this guy who's a spokesperson just with his art, and drawing people in just with his art. And it was a huge part of the Panther movement. It was a huge part of how, you know, we and people all over the country learned about the Panthers was through Emery's art. A lot of people, that was the first thing that you saw was the Panther paper with his art on the cover. And you said, oh my God, look at this incredible painting. Okay, let me see what else is in this paper. And that's how you got into it.
You know, there's another thing that you started to hit on, which really struck me too, is exactly that point of the two styles that he had. But it was also, it was more than just the styles, because he had this portrayal that I think really fought a battle for the humanization and the dignity of the people.
Right.
And then on the other hand, to just totally, you know, just, these are the idea that these, and I remember that, you know, the thing that always struck me about the pigs, the flies that were always buzzing around.
Right, right.
But it was just like they were not human. They, you know, these are people, this is, they're not just the enemy, but they're just not even human.
Right.
You know, and it was a real, really good way in terms of that, what we're talking about, bringing new standards to the people, to the community, and also fighting to actually polarize things in the sense of these are the people, this is the enemy.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the Panthers' whole program. I mean, you know, Emery's art, but also what they said, how they said it, was, you know, your first reaction was like, wait a minute, you can't say this. Wait a minute, you can't do this. But, oh, you can do it. Oh, you can say it. Oh, you can have a drawing of Lyndon Johnson, you know, being hung with people sticking bayonets in him. You can have that. You can have, you know, a bomb planted under the White House or the Congress. You know, you can do that. You know, and it was revolutionary to all of us because, you know, you hadn't had that before. You hadn't had this kind of, yeah, I can say whatever I want. You know.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That's exactly the point. Yeah, very important.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Nelson, the director of The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, the first documentary on the most prominent revolutionary group during the 1960s.
Everything we've been talking about up to this point the swagger, the seriousness, the audaciousness, the declaration of we're the vanguard of the revolution. You know, it's interesting because you did a really interesting way of portraying this. It had such a major impact broadly throughout society, and not just among black people, but white people, all kinds of people were in there. But particularly, the one scene that I remember as a kid was the Mike Douglas show, and John Lennon bringing on.
Right. We have a whole section of the film about kind of the media attention of the Panthers, and the Panthers as media darlings, and it ends with this. With this clip from the Mike Douglas show, and I'm not sure why, but John Lennon is sitting there in Yoko Ono, and John Lennon is the one who introduces Bobby Seale. So he says, you know, here's Bobby Seale, the chairman of the Black Panther Party, you know, in his, I won't try to imitate him, but in his British accent, and Bobby Seale comes out and shakes hands with John Lennon and Yoko and Mike Douglas, and then proceeds to talk about the Breakfast for Children program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it said something about, again, the influence of the Panthers on the times. You know, because you're looking at this and it's like, wow, this is sort of the breadth of this.
Right.
And it gave, you know, it also gave you a sense of what's possible. It's necessary, but it's also possible. You know, even in terms of what happens today. For instance, the need, we were talking earlier about the need for people to stand up, mm-hmm. around the kinds of things, the genocidal assault by the police against young black men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think hopefully that's one of the things that the film does, is through scenes like that, which are kind of subtle. We don't ever say anything about the fact that it's John Lennon, but I think 95% of the audience will know that it's John Lennon. You know, there's another scene with Brando making a speech, you know, in support of the Panthers at a Panther rally. There's Jane Fonda having a fundraiser at her house. We want to give you the sense that, you know, the Panthers weren't as isolated as we've come to know them, that they had broad support. There's so many rallies that we kind of just show a picture of where the audience is 90% white. You know, that's who the audience were. There's Asians with signs, you know, in Chinese, supporting Huey Newton, you know, and there's some funny signs, you know, the Yellow Peril wants to free Huey and stuff like that. So, you know, we really wanted to give an idea that there was this broad-based support for the Panthers, which is really different than how it's come down through history, where we feel like, oh, the Black Panthers were this scary black radical group with guns and they, you know, were isolationists. No, the Panthers, and this is very clear in the film, and this is a point that we really wanted to make, and we wanted to make it more strongly as we went on, because as we went on with the research of the film, we found that this was true, that the Panthers had a lot of support from white people. And the Panthers never made statements against white people. They were very clear about that. They made statements against the brutality of the police and the corruption of the government and the lack of resources in the black community, but it was never aimed at white people in general. They welcomed and needed support of white people all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this, because soon after they formed, I mean, they had three key leaders in that group, and they each had, they brought critical strengths to it, but they were coming from different places, mm-hmm. you know, but they all contributed key elements of this thing, and it was something that I think really made the thing work to a certain extent too, in terms of the, like Huey being more, as you say in the film, more visionary, Bobby having more the basically going out and being out there and being the sort of spokesperson for the group, and then Eldridge and what he brought to it, you know, and even with Eldridge, it was another thing that Eldridge brought. I mean, I remember Bob Avakian talks about this when he first, you know, he was writing for Ramparts and he first met Eldridge. And he said he walked into Eldridge's house and he looked up the stairway and there was a massive photo of Mao there. Uh-huh. And, you know, and Bob said, "Who's that?" And he goes, "That's the baddest on the face of the earth, man." It's like, which made Bob then go back and say, "I got to find out who this cat is." But right. There was these guys, these three leaders that came from very different places in society to a certain extent, very different approaches to things, but they came together to actually form this, and it made a difference in terms of that you had these three very outstanding leaders that had played a big role in actually the Panthers becoming what they were.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why the Panthers became what they've become, why we're still talking about the Panthers today, is their leadership, you know, at least at the beginning, was this incredible convergence of luck, you know, to have these three guys, because they each had individual skills and each had their own piece of brand of charisma, and it's just this crazy thing that happens where they all come together and become the leadership of the Panthers. Unfortunately, what happens is they don't spend a lot of time together, because there's always a problem. Huey goes to prison and is on trial for a couple of years for killing a policeman. It becomes a Free Huey movement. So he's in jail most of the time. Eldridge Cleaver is on parole and goes to Algeria on the run, and Bobby Seale is in and out of prison on different little charges connected with what the Panthers were doing. So they had this wonderful leadership, but unfortunately, who knows what would have happened if that leadership had really had the chance to get together, you know, and be together and really form a united strategy. And also, I think what it does that proves itself out later in the film is that they don't really know each other because they're never together. They're not really ever, you know, in the same room. So they, you know, Huey and Bobby know each other. Eldridge doesn't know. And so without knowing somebody in that way, you can tend to believe anything about them.
Well, one very important point, too, which I think a lot of people don't really recognize, is that very, very early on in the history of the Panthers, the repression by the state, particularly focused against their leadership, was very heavy.
Right. Right. Well, Huey goes to jail, and the Panthers started in 66. Huey goes to jail for murdering this cop and is in jail the whole time in 67, and goes and is there for a couple of years. And so at the whole time the Panthers are rising, Huey, you know, who's really the strategist behind the whole thing, is in jail. You know, as Kathleen Cleaver says, you know, when she went out there to help Eldridge start the Free Huey movement, there were like five or six Panthers left who weren't in jail. So, you know, they had invaded the legislature in Sacramento, which was perfectly legal to carry guns. You know, that was a California law. But they were tried on various charges for that. So the guys who had started the Panthers were in and out of jail in connection with that. And as Kathleen says, well, Huey gets shot and goes to jail and then is on trial for this murder. When she goes, there's like five or six people in the Panther Party. And as she said, they were all like 16 and 17. It was her and Eldridge and a bunch of kids.
All right, we have to stop the interview there. But remember, you can always listen to the interview in its entirety at my website, and that's themichaelslateshow.com. All right, I want to thank all of my guests today, Ed Asner, Sharon and Andrea Irwin, and Stanley Nelson. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at my new address, mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, and as we go out, for all of you who are interested in finding out more information about Rise Up October, everything that's going on in New York City and around the country, go to riseupoctober.org. All right, that's riseupoctober.org. You can also go to stopmassincarceration.net. We're going to go out now with a song from yet another Panther, Elaine Brown, and the song is Until We're Free. Talk to you again next week.
Yes, I remember the yesterdays, the poverty that you and me survived. For we tried living on streets that weren't giving, and laughed and cried in youth we died and didn't know. Memory shall carry me until we're free. The times we saw we didn't deserve, hostility we couldn't see, it was absurd. But we gave joy, each girl and boy, so innocent our future bent against the wind. Yes, my friends,
our history,
the memory.